What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Christopher Gimmer is a serial entrepreneur and the co-founder of Snappa.com, an app that helps non-designers create awesome online graphics. He's also the co-founder of Bitbo.io, a fresh and dope dashboard for all things Bitcoin. And he's the author of several notable blog posts on entrepreneurship, Bitcoin as a treasury asset, and the final stair step, combining business with personal passion. The continuous builder of flywheels. Welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, Chris. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
I heard you on, you know, Tales from the Crypt among some other places, and I think that was a great pod. I definitely think people should check it out. That, like, I was just like, I want to talk to you right away. And that got me really excited. And that also brought me back to your post that I'd read before, the one about the corporate treasury reserve assets. And then I started reading the other ones, and I kind of wanted to talk about a lot more than just Bitbo.
Cool.
Yeah, man. So, like, one of the first things I noticed, and it was kind of tricky to get to, was your post on sort of like planting the seed, because it was a link from one of the kind of the articles on your main account, chrisgimmer.com. And I didn't really see that one as a separate article until I saw the link. And I thought that was really interesting that, you know, you went on this trip, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. Your experience.
Yeah. So, just very quick background. So I went to school, or went to university and had a background in finance and accounting. And then I started working in, the government, in kind of like a financial analyst role. And so I did that for 5 years. And you know, it was just kind of going through the motions and was following, you know, a typical life script of going to school and get a good job and that kind of stuff. And then in May of 2010, I went to Southeast Asia with a buddy of mine, and it was just such a phenomenal trip because, you know, the culture was, you know, unlike anything I've experienced before. Just being a month in just a completely different, you know, society and just, you know, having such amazing experiences. And I remember like the last couple of days, just absolutely dreading the thought of going back to my cubicle and stuff like that. And so, you know, that was kind of the first time in my life where I really was like, man, you know, it would be nice to be able to do this more than just once a year when I get my vacation time. And that's when I started thinking about like, you know, maybe I should be starting my own business and maybe I should kind of be following somewhat of a different career path where I don't have to, you know, go to an office every day and, you know, push papers around and that kind of stuff. So yeah, that was where I really started to, you know, have some of these thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, I had a similar experience. When I was 25, I took 3 months off during a career change and I traveled to South Pacific by myself. And it was a transformative experience. And yeah, it's one of the reasons I wanted to bring it up. And I'm kind of curious. So like, what is Snappa? So I kind of get the gist of it. You know, it's going to help me create online graphics. But like, let's say I'm a small business owner and I'm struggling with my graphics. Someone's like, use Snappa. So what would that be for me as a small business owner?
Yeah, so nowadays, obviously, there's just so much content online, and especially with, you know, as we've seen with the pandemic and, you know, whole digital transformation, what people are realizing is that like, if you're a business and you don't have an online presence, you know, you're making a big, you're making a mistake. And so the issue now is if you're a small business owner and, you know, you've got a limited budget, you're on, you know, tight deadlines, it's becoming really inefficient to hire, you know, professional graphic designers to design something for your Facebook or Twitter, where as soon as you post it, it's going to disappear in the feed within like a couple hours or a day, right? Because there's just so much content on these feeds. So the idea with Snappa is that, you know, instead of spending a lot of money and doing a bunch of back and forth with a graphic designer, you can just create the graphic yourself. So we have a bunch of preset sizes and a bunch of templates. So let's say, you know, you're a store, you're selling on Shopify, you've got a sale coming up and you want to post, this out to your Facebook audience. So you would go into Snappa, you would click Facebook, you would select a template that kind of matches what you need. And then it's literally a matter of, you know, swapping out the background image, editing the text. And then within a few minutes, you've got your graphic. So it basically is just saving you lots of time and money compared to, you know, hiring out this kind of stuff. It's also really popular among like full-time marketers. So the people who are, you know, writing a lot of blog content or who, you know, are basically full-time, you know, social media managers. Again, like they can crank out this content and create a lot of these images and do it really quickly and easily themselves. And it, you know, just saves a lot of time and money.
Yeah, I can see that. It sounds awesome because I've always worked at large corporations as a consultant, but, you know, kind of even just being on Twitter, there's been things I wanted to do with graphics and I've run up to that wall. And so I have a feeling I'm going to be on Snappa very soon. And even more so with the pod. So, you know, that sounds like a completely, you know, fleshed out, awesome product. So how do we get there? You know, I'm guessing, you know, you connect with Mark at some point after maybe this journey of yours to Southeast Asia. And how do you guys get to building out this product? And there was a lot of things that I read along the way that you know, I'd love to get into, like around like flywheel and step climbing. So maybe we can just kind of.
Yeah. So long story short, so Mark, we met at work. One day this guy strolls into the office and he was hired by a temp help agency. And most of the people in the office were a lot older than me. So obviously Mark and I kind of, became friends, you know, pretty quickly because we were around the same age and, you know, fortunately we had a lot of similar interests and stuff like that. And then, I found out that he was, you know, he did programming on the side and I was like, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. And then, you know, the gears started spinning in my head where I was like, well, this, you know, this guy knows how to program and, you know, I'm trying to you know, get more freedom on my life and starting to, you know, dream about this whole, you know, running an online business and being able to travel more and stuff like that. And so we ended up working on a couple things. We had a couple false starts, but one website we launched was a marketplace for essentially like website themes and templates that had some success. I think at its peak, we're maybe doing like $4,000 or $5,000 a month in profit. So it wasn't enough that, you know, we can quit our jobs or anything, but you know, we're kind of learning like how this all works and how to do online marketing, how to launch products. And so while we were working on that site, you know, I was writing a lot of blog content and that's how we were getting our traffic. And, you know, I came to this issue where I needed to create these graphics for our blog and I was, you know, messing around with Photoshop. I wasn't a graphic designer. We didn't have, you know, the budget to hire. And so kind of experienced the pain point, which, you know, Snappa ultimately solves. And so there's a couple things that kind of, you know, couple things after that led to launching Snappa. But essentially that's where the original idea came from. And then the next steps after that were essentially, we had a blog post that was ranking really well for where to find free stock photos. We ended up then launching our own free stock photo site. And then we used those two properties to promote or we ended up building Snappa and then we used those two properties to kind of funnel that traffic into Snappa. So that's kind of the quick version of how that kind of came right to be.
There were, from what I remember, there were a lot of like tricks in your trade here. I mean, you were blogging, but you were kind of also seeing where things were like popping off and going viral, maybe on Reddit. You were noticing which blogs were taking off and then maybe kind of keying into those categories. Also, I think one of these startups that you had was Bootstrap Bay.
Yeah, that was the website for themes and templates. So yeah, so essentially what happened was, you know, I was on Reddit and I noted, and someone had posted just a thread of where to, you know, a bunch of websites with really good free stock photos, and it was getting it to a lot of upvotes, and I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And this is kind of when you know, sites like Unsplash, in these kind of Creative Commons free websites were coming out, which at the time was, you know, pretty awesome, because a lot of, you know, the stock photo sites at the time are really cheesy, and you know, it didn't look like, you know, legit photography. And so I was kind of reading a lot about, you know, SEO and content marketing and stuff. And so essentially there's a thing called the skyscraper technique, which is, you know, you find content that is, you know, already doing well or ranking online, and basically creating like a 10x version of that. Hmm. And so, you know, essentially I was like, okay, this, obviously there's an appetite here, but it was literally just a list of links. And so what I did was I took those resources, you know, added a bunch more, and then, you know, wrote a really detailed blog post outlining, you know, what are the ins and outs of all these sites, what license each of these fall under, you know, a couple, you know, images. And then when I published that and put it on Reddit, and there's a website StumbleUpon, which was really popular at the time, and getting shared on Facebook, and that post ended up going viral, and we started ranking in Google for free stock photos. And then, so that's kind of when we leveraged that into launching one of our own free stock photo sites. And so now all of a sudden we had these two properties that people are coming to get free stock photos. And we knew that, or, you know, we had the idea for Snappa at the time. And so we started, you know, polling some of the our audience and kind of figuring out if you know, a graphic design tool was kind of you know, gearing towards non-designers was something that they needed. And through our customer research, we did in fact find that there was a need for this product, and so that gave us the confidence to go ahead and build it. And then we already had the traffic from day one to actually go and promote our tool.
Sure. What I'm seeing here, especially over the arc of your blogs and the stories, is I am seeing sort of like a consistent narrative and a lot of, in your life, connecting of different skill sets and dots, both personally and professionally, to create and to not just create value, you know, with a SaaS company. I want to talk a little bit about what a SaaS company is as well, but also kind of like create value for yourself in the future. And I've seen that in your writing all the way back to 2017, before you were like a public Bitcoiner. What I really appreciate from your writing is it's very honest, especially about specifics with your business. And I think that's very helpful to people. And I don't think that's easy I would assume it's not easy for you or any business owner to do. One thing I'm curious about though, is like outside of business, how much were you like online and getting a kick out of like things like virality and feedback, whether it was just in your personal social media, like, you know, being able to like make craft a tweet and just seeing how it performed, you know, versus and then bringing that into your business life? Because I ask, like, maybe not everyone brings that skill to their business life.
Yeah. I never consider myself a very creative person, to be honest. I consider myself more of like a math and numbers type of guy. And so one of the things I got really good at was SEO and search engine optimization, because it's a bit more of like a math and methodical thing where you can kind of do the research, see what people are searching for, see how many or how difficult it would be to rank for that and that kind of stuff. But the thing with writing and what I've learned and even on my personal site is, so the writing that I did for the company blog was a bit more strategic, and more focused on the SEO kind of thing. Whereas my personal website, I'm not like, I don't treat it as business. It's really more of just, part of it is for fun. Part of it is just to get, you know, better at writing. Part of it is to just share my thoughts and just kind of, you know, put myself out there and kind of see what sticks. So I'm much less methodical about what I'm writing on my personal site in terms of like, do I think this is going to get me traffic? I kind of just put it out there and hopefully it resonates with people and hopefully it's helpful. And what I found is that, you know, there's definitely that like 80-20 rule where, you know, 20% of the blog posts are getting like 80% of the traffic and the thing is, like, you can never really time that. There's some posts where I wrote and I was like, you know, I think this is a really awesome post and this is going to blow up. and, you know, it did okay. And then there's others that I just kind of put it out there. Like the Bitcoin, the Bitcoin article I wrote, I had no freaking clue that it was going to blow up the way that it did and was so well received. And it's one of those things where like, you just can't predict that and you can't time it. So yeah. And that's kind of the approach that I've taken for my personal site is like, I'm just going to put, you know, what I feel like writing and, you know, if it does well, great. If it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I get it. I'm more of the analytical side. My impression is though, that I feel there's a creativity to even analytics and accepting the feedback and then looking for the clues. Another thing I noticed, you know, is you had to make some tough decisions along the way. What I would imagine was a big fork in the road was continuing on with that, getting your CPA. You know, and what kind of decision was that like? And in retrospect, what has changed since and your views on that decision now?
Yeah. So, kind of like I was alluding to before, I was, especially growing up and in my early 20s, I was always a very risk averse person. And so, like I said, I kind of chose my career path, kind of like, you know, this job is going to pay well and, you know, it's going to be secure and I'm going to have a pension kind of thing. But it's not like I was super psyched to, you know, go into the federal government and work in that kind of role. And then so kind of, again, like I was alluding to before, I kind of came to this fork in the road where I realized like, you know, I'm not going to be happy doing this for the next, you know, 20, 30 years or whatever. And so when Mark and I were, you know, working on these businesses and launching these products, I eventually got to the point with Bootstrap Bay where, you know, again, we're making like $4,000 or $5,000 in profit. So, you know, nothing like what I was, you know, making in my job at the time and, you know, a lot of uncertainty. And so, but I, again, I got to that point where I was like, I know that I'm not going to be happy doing this for another 20-30 years. And, you know, I really enjoyed this, you know, the online marketing and you know, trying to be, you know, be my own boss and that kind of stuff. And so what I did was I took a year of absence from work so that I can focus on this 100%. And my thinking at the time was, well, even if you know, we can't get the business to the point where it's making enough money to support herself, you know, hopefully that, you know, I've developed these skills that I can go work for like, you know, a tech company or something, a little more, something that I would enjoy a little more. And at the time I was 2 years into my CPA accounting designation, my work was paying for it. And obviously the agreement was like, I had to stay with them for at least 2 years after I finished it. So essentially I knew that by dropping out, I would, you know, owe them, you know, I'd have to pay back the $10,000. And if I ever asked for my job or if I came back after that year leave of absence, I actually would have got demoted because I was in an acting position. And I had that acting position because I agreed to do my accounting designation. So for me, that was like one of the pivotal moments in my life, I would say, because, you know, I had this super stable job. I had a pension, like, you know, from my parents and friends point of view, like I'm doing good, but I wasn't happy. And at the end of the day, again, I was like, I have to prioritize my happiness right now. And, you know, start taking some risks. Like I'm still pretty young. You know, I wasn't married at the time. I'm engaged now and, you know, no kids and whatever. And so I took that leap of faith and fortunately it worked out for the best.
Yeah. I think it's a very low time preference move. I went through a very similar thing. I was at one of the big four accounting firms. They actually sent me to grad school. I got my master's in accounting while working for them. They even sent me full time, paid for me while I wasn't working to go there. And then I had to work 3 years after to wrap up and to not owe them anything if I left. And in my last year, because my intention was always to leave the day that my contract was up. I had t-shirts printed up years before. And I got one of my buddies a job there. And to get The bonus, I had to stay like 3 months after my end date. And that bonus is what paid for me to go through the South Pacific when I went backpacking by myself. So I really appreciate, you know, sort of like that low time preference. I'm going to invest in myself and bank on that I can pull this off and figure out a happier future for myself. If I take the almost like a pay cut now, or definitely it was a pay cut for me. I went to film school after that. And what I also thought was really interesting was you kind of talking about how you had to go through the decision to buy snappa.com. It was very interesting where you're launching the business and there's all these kind of moments where, you know, you launch a beta site and you get that reaction. And that's the feedback loop that I think is whether we describe it as creative or not, but like kind of trying to interact with people and what's working and whether it's analytical because this is the content they want. And I got to write this very bookish content. Maybe the content's not creative, but thinking about what is ticking them off or working. But now you got months of maybe beta. And I think that's kind of interesting where, you know, you got to code out to get to the next launch. And you know, what the impatience must be like there. But then, you know, you had to go with snappa.io at first to get, to get, you know, your foot in the door. And now you're there and things are going well. But you want to take the next step. And I kind of curious, why is it so important that you get snappa.com, not snappa.io? And why'd you make the investment?
Yeah, so when we first started, we kind of came up with the name Snappa. We really liked that and kind of symbolized, you know, the product. And for a variety of reasons, we really liked the name. And, you know, nowadays it's really hard to get .com. So, you know, on day one, when we're, you know, making $0, we're like, all right, let's just roll with .io. It's the next best thing. So, I'm trying to remember, I think around that time we were probably doing, I want to say $20,000 to $25,000 a month in recurring revenue.
Right.
And, you know, the growth was solid. Like, you know, for like, we were bootstrapped, we hadn't raised money. So, you know, 25K a month, you know, this was, it was clear that, you know, this thing had legs. So at that time we were like, okay, well, you know, maybe we should, you know, look into getting the .com. And I think we had looked into getting the .com like very early on, and, you know, whoever owned it was like, yeah, it's 80 grand or something like that. And I was like, yeah, that's not going to happen. Or like 70 grand or whatever. So right. Then, yeah.
Which
so
is just the first approach.
Yeah. That was the first approach. And then I was like, okay, I'm not even going to try to negotiate this, 'cause like, we're just so far off here.
Yeah. And I'd love for you to, you know, just, I didn't mean to interrupt, but like the way you walk through negotiations in your blog, I think is really important. Just, and it's not just about websites, the way you walk through the negotiation. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but it's,
oh yeah, no worries. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, like on day one, you know, we basically have $0. So I'm not even going to bother trying to negotiate with whatever the price was. And then, so 2 years later, again, we're at 20, sitting at 20, 25K recurring revenue. And I was like, okay, you know, maybe we should look into this a bit more seriously, because, you know, we knew this business was going to have legs. Sent the buyer another email. And, if I remember correctly, the price had actually increased. So I think the first time was like 75K, and then now they come back with 85K. And I'm like, you gotta be freaking kidding me. And then, so I think I just kind of lowballed right away. And I was like, listen, like, we're a small startup, you know, all we have is like 20K kind of thing. And they're like, oh no, sorry, it's, you know, 85 or it's like 80K, or maybe they put it down to like 70 or whatever. And then I think we had kind of somewhat gone back and forth a couple times and just, you know, wasn't happening. And then, so I talked to Mark, my business partner. I was like, listen, like, you know, I don't want to waste too much time with this. Like, how much are we willing to pay here? And I think we both kind of came up with 40,000 or something like that. And so I went back and I was like, listen, this is our best offer, take it or leave it kind of thing. And originally they were like, no, sorry, that's still too low. Like, we're, you know, and I think they might've said like 60K at that point, and some kind of payment plan, and, you know, still wasn't going to work. You know, we're giving you a discount. And, you know, I think one of the most important things with negotiations is be willing to walk away. Right. And at the time I was like, yeah, I wanted the .com, but, you know, we're growing nicely. It's not like we absolutely have to have this or we weren't going to have a business. And so I said, you know, sorry, unfortunately, this is our best offer. You know, we're not going to, you know, put ourselves in a bad position with this. And said, you know, we're not willing to go any higher than that. And then I want to say like a couple days later, the person come back and said, oh, we, you know, we went back to, you know, I guess the powers that be and they've have accepted your offer. And then, so we were able to finally close on that. And I think it was like 20 grand up front. And then the other 20 grand was paid over 2 years or something like that.
Yeah.
But then we actually had a really good, you know, pretty solid year. And then I think we just ended up just paying it off within like, you know, 6 months later or something like that. Just to get that off our chest.
Right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of things, you know, it reminded me of a lot of what Michael Saylor has been talking about currently and what he's gone through in the past with alarm.com and now hope.com and kind of seizing value and holding on to it. It was kind of interesting. You talked about branding and trust and really like even just avoiding confusion, which you bring it up in your article. A lot of sites that we know now is like, you know, like square.com or facebook.com were not like that in the beginning. Like it was the facebook.com is very famous in the movie as a scene, or Twitter was like twttr.com. So I thought that was really interesting. And I wonder, like, you know, you mentioned like you gotta be willing to walk away, and like how much do you think that you kind of talk about it in the article where you show some quick facts up front, like how your numbers went up when you jump over to snappa.com. But even now, like how frustrating would it be to keep getting an email once in a while when someone's like, I'm at snappa.com and your website's down, or I'm at.
The thing that was frustrating was like, if you entered snappa.com into a web browser, I think it had some like random, like essentially it seemed like the website wasn't there, it wasn't working. And, you know, as much as most people just type things into Google or like, you know, they'll bookmark things, you know, there are still, believe it or not, a lot of people that just type things and put .com and right. Hit enter. And so after we got a couple emails, and yeah, I put a screenshot in that post, and I remember this one woman was writing us support, and for a while we were having trouble, like, you know, what's going on here? And then eventually I figured out, like, oh my God, she's typing snappa.com. That's why it's not working for her. So, I mean, these kinds of things are like super hard to quantify. Obviously we've grown pretty substantially since we've got the .com, but I mean, it's impossible to say how much is that actually attributed to, you know, the .com itself.
Right.
I think it definitely helps. I would like to think that even with .io, we still would have grown a pretty successful company. But like you said, trust is really important. And at the end of the day, like .com is always going to be, you know, the ultimate, domain extension. And so, you know, that's why a lot of people at a certain point, if they grow enough, they do try to land that, that.com. And then, you know, you don't have to worry about other people building and other sites and confusing people and whatnot. So, you know, worked out, really happy that we did it. You know, considering what we've grown to, $40,000 was absolutely worth it for us. You know, you hear some crazy Michael Saylor's, I think this was like nuts, like $75 million or something like that. I can't remember now. You know, another, I think the one that I quoted in the blog post was teamwork.com. I think they paid like $675,000 or something like that. So in the grand scheme of things, 40K wasn't that bad.
Yeah. I would be, you know, as a numbers guy and very analytical, I would be super frustrated by every email I got like that, because that to me, I would just be trying to figure out and quantify how many other people did not email me. And then I'm thinking, oh, those people are gone forever. They're going to find a solution somewhere else, and I'm never going to get them back. And that would be the itch I would be always constantly scratching if I thought my business needed the .com. Mm-hmm. You know, once you get it in your head, you know, for every business it might be different. But if I got that in my head about my business, I wouldn't yeah, I don't want to say anything because then I don't want to compete with anybody for prices. But you know, that is how I feel. And I understand why you want to seize that. What also I think was interesting, and you know, because you talk a lot about numbers in your blog posts. And I think it's just amazing that you're so transparent. So you're scaling the business from 20,000 to 25,000, I think a month, maybe you said, to you know, 1 million a year. And you're using this like marketing flywheel sort of like theory or techniques. And so like, how do you find your core channel? You know, and before we get into that though, like what, like just define a SaaS. So like, how does it work on your end? And from like just a quick overview of the business model. So maybe anyone who's not familiar can kind of understand, you know, what you built on sort of like a recurring side for your set for the business.
Yeah, SaaS is basically, well, it stands for software as a service. So it's essentially a software product that you're delivering usually via the cloud on a subscription basis. And, you know, especially for, you know, a bootstrapped or self-funded founders, it's an incredible business model because unlike, you know, an e-commerce store where theoretically, every month you're starting at zero. With a SaaS business, the revenue is recurring. So even if you don't bring in any new customers from 1 month to the next, and assuming none of those cancel, you're still going to make that same amount of money every single month, which is incredibly powerful because you know it helps you plan and forecast better. It's just much more stable, helps you sleep at night. So it definitely is quite a really good business model, and it takes out, you know, a lot of seasonality within the business as well. So that's kind of SaaS in a nutshell.
Right.
And one other cool thing with SaaS is typically what most people do is there's a monthly payment plan. And then typically what a lot of people do, including ourselves, is they'll offer like a yearly plan with like a, you know, let's call it a 10 to 20% discount. And this is really powerful because if you get, let's say, 20% of your user base paying you for a year upfront, well, now all of a sudden you're really cash flow positive, right? So if you're selling a subscription for, you know, let's call it 10 bucks a month, and then you have a yearly plan for $100 for the year, and now 20% of those are paying $100, you can see the math works really in your favor. Whereas a product business, you actually have to, a lot of people who have to scale product businesses, it's really challenging because they have to pay for the inventory ahead of time before they sell it. So a lot of times when they're growing really fast, they end up having to either take on debt or they have to grow more slowly than they actually can. Whereas SaaS business is the opposite. You're getting more cash than you need up front. And so you can kind of like overspend a little bit, and that helps you like really scale up quickly.
Right. So you know, I mean, I would think that these are getting harder and harder to build. How did you guys zero in on like what is your core channel? You know, I'm looking at this graphic for a bullseye framework, and you know, you kind of have the outer ring of what's possible, your middle ring of what's probable, and your inner ring of what's working. So how did you guys kind of zero in on your inner ring, I'm guessing, and how did you test your channel? And like, what's the flywheel in action?
So anyone who's thinking about launching a startup or doing any sort of online marketing, one of my favorite books is called Traction by Gabriel Weinberg and Justin Mares. And essentially it provides a really good framework to go about marketing. And essentially you've got, you know, a variety, I think in the book, there's like 21 marketing channels and they're all kind of different. And so the whole idea of the bullseye framework is you look at all of these 21 channels and then you kind of split them out into what's probably not going to work, what's maybe likely to work, and then kind of what are the two or three high probability stuff. And then you start running a bunch of tests around these channels. And what I like to focus on is unit economics. So for example, let's say you're a consultant and you charge $10,000 and you're like a super high end, you know, consultant kind of thing. Well, if you're making $10,000 per client, I mean, you can go to trade shows, you can do cold emails, you can phone people one by one, because you only need one person to make $10,000, right? So even if you land one client a month or two clients a month, that's pretty solid. Now, if you've got a software app that you're only charging $5 a month, well, you're not going to go to trade shows and you're not going to cold email people and you're not going to hop on the phone, because there's no way that you're going to make that profitable if it's only $5 a month. And so you need to find marketing channels that are way more scalable and, you know, free, if you will. So, you know, with Snappa, we charge $15 a month or $120 per year. So right off the bat, based on our unit economics, that's going to rule out, you know, quite a lot of these, you know, manual or time intensive channels. And so one of the ones that we zeroed in on, or two of the channels we zeroed in on, was content marketing and SEO. Because what we found was there was a lot of search volume related to keywords and use cases that our product solves. And so the theory is, like, you know, we can spend, let's call it 8 hours to write one blog post, and that one blog post could generate thousands of views per month, or you know, a couple hundred views per day. And then you start doing the math, right? So if you get, you know, 5,000 people, and then, you know, 10% of those, you know, click on the homepage, now you're down to 500. If 20% of those people sign up, you know, now you're down to 100. And then if, you know, 2% of those people, or how whatever percent, sure, convert to a paid, the math starts to work out, right? And so we knew, like, we needed these marketing channels that could provide, you know, really, that had the volume that could support the unit economics of our business. And so what our flywheel ended up looking like is that the really powerful thing with SEO is that it almost is a flywheel in itself. So essentially the way it works is the higher Google views your site in terms of, like, trust and authority, the easier it is going to be to rank for future keywords, right? And this is why you like, if you're a brand new website, it's going to be really, really difficult to rank for competitive keywords. Whereas if you're a site that's been around for 5-10 years, you've got thousands and thousands of backlinks, a lot of websites are linking to you, you're a very trustworthy site. Well, if you publish a new piece of content, Google is more willing to rank you for that piece of content right away, as opposed to, like, a brand new site. And so what we found was we started, you know, ranking for a blog post here and a blog post there. We started generating more backlinks. And then it just becomes this flywheel, this reinforcing loop, where each extra post that you publish, if you can get more backlinks to that, it increases the overall authority of your domain, which helps you rank for another post. And then it just becomes this virtuous cycle. And then, so, you know, the majority of our traffic to Snappa comes through these, you know, the content and SEO, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like you're on the flywheel of life. You know, like, when do you think all this was, like, clicking for you? Was it really just through going through the machinations of learning, or were you kind of getting these bigger ideas before you put them into action through your readings and your life experiences?
So I wrote a post, an article about this on my site called Playing the Long Game, or Why It Pays to Play the Long Game. Mm-hmm. And this has kind of become, like, my life philosophy.
That's all I see in this.
Yeah,
you know, because I wouldn't want to say, like, you're patient in the sense of, like, you're accomplishing so much, and if I look at it on paper, I don't think of this, any of this is patient. But it was interesting when I read about, like, starting the company. I'm like, you know, because after the fact, you're like, well, they went beta and they were at this, and then they went this and they did that. And I'm like, wait a minute, they had to wait 5 months to launch the real version of the thing that's working. And so that's where the long, you know, playing the long game, I see it through everything that you're doing. And I also see a lot of just goodwill in terms of, like, how you know, building a great team you know, you talk about how there's no way you would have accomplished the financial success of the company without this team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I didn't mean to kind of jump in there either, but because I want you to continue with your thought about playing the long game.
Yeah. So essentially what I've kind of realized was like, you know, there's that famous quote, you overestimate what you can do in a year and underestimate what you can right. do in 10 years, something, right. something to that effect.
Bill Gates, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And similar to like the SEO flywheel, I feel like this is also becoming this like self-reinforcing loop in my life where, you know, if I go back to 2012 or 2013, you know, I was just starting out with this stuff. And, you know, and then in 2014, we had launched Bootstrap A and we're doing like a couple grand a month in profit. And now looking back, you know, that was essentially nothing. Right. But at the time I was like, holy shit, like we're making money online. You know, we built this thing from nothing. You know, maybe we can build. Yeah, exactly. Like, and it's like,
you kind of getting that, you know.
Yeah, like maybe we can build this thing to 10K. And then once you get to like 10K, it's like, wow, like it took us 2 years to get here. But, you know, if we just keep at this thing, like, you know, we can probably get to 20 and we could get to 30. And then, you know, I just kind of embraced this where it's like, I work on stuff now. And I know that is probably going to take like a year or two to see the results from it. But because I've been doing this for the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, I've just got accustomed to thinking about, you know, business and life in terms of like compounding interest, right? So if you just every day, you know, put in the work and do what you got to do, that shit will compound for the rest. And if you just do that day in and day out, like you're gonna get results, right?
Right.
It's the same thing with working out. Like, you know, you're not gonna see a ton of results in the first week of going to the gym, and most people give up. But if you keep at it for, you know, months and years, you're gonna look back and you're gonna be like, holy crap, like I can't believe, you know, I've got such amazing results. And this is the same thing with business. I would have never imagined being able to build, you know, $1 million SaaS app in, you know, 4 years or whatever. And kind of it just continues to exceed expectations. And so that's just kind of my thing now is I just always try to keep a long view, understanding compounding returns. And I'm sure Bitcoiners understand this, right? Like it's really... I find the investors are very rewarded for patience. And so that's definitely something I try to embody in kind of all aspects of my life.
Well, yeah, I think Bitcoiners get compounding, but I think you bring it to your life in a very demonstrated way. And it's more, you know, it's almost, and you touch on this in your writings, it's exponentiality. And kind of seeing the how, you know, the hockey stick in all your endeavors. And I do want to get into compounding because you have a good piece on that and also working out because you have another blog post on that I found really interesting. But before we touch on that, you know, it's like I do want to touch on, you know, now you guys, I think you hired your fifth full-time employee in May, which is, mm-hmm. is now a while ago. Is that in addition to you and Mark? And just to, I want to shout out to him just because he's a big part of everything you do. So I don't want to ignore him. So are you now at seven or more now at this point?
Yeah. So seven in total. If you include
that's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot. That's kind of big, but it also, it's very, at the same time, like you have a lot of control and you mm-hmm. can kind of really, you know, pour your heart and soul into each and every decision before you get a little bit more spread out. So how do you go about establishing a great culture? Because, you know, at the same time where you have more ability to control, each and every player is going to affect you more and can kind of fuck shit up more if things go wrong. And one thing I'm noticing is you kind of take a long view with culture and with people and bringing people on. So, you know, what are you doing these days to kind of build out the company and get not, I don't want to say so much out of people, like you're driving them, but like how to empower them. And
Yeah, so that word right there, empower them, is what it's all about. And so I think the worst thing that you can do as a manager, as a leader, is micromanage, right? If you have to micromanage someone, there's either something wrong with you or you hired the wrong person. So the way that we kind of establish our culture is, number one, you know, we want to make sure that we're hiring the right people right off the bat. So obviously we look for people that are just, you know, smart and intelligent. But beyond that, have, you know, really good attitude, people who are self-learners, people who, you know, can manage themselves, can bring ideas to the table, are passionate about what they do, you know, all those kinds of good things. And then, you know, my job is to basically be there to help them when they need it. But ultimately to let them do what they do and to kind of get out of their way. Because, you know, everyone that we've hired are amazing at what they do, much better than, you know, like, I'm not a graphic designer. I'm not an expert on, you know, social media. Our marketing managers, killing it on, I mean, marketing is the one thing that I guess I am kind of good at. But even then, like, I let him do his thing and I got out of his way. And I think that is, you know, the best way to build a team. And fortunately, with a smaller team of, you know, seven people, I think it's much easier to have much more of a hands-off approach. And especially when everyone kind of, you know, knows what they got to do and their own role. And, you know, we try to just offer a really good, you know, work environment. You know, everyone, you know, there's a time for fun. There's a time for hard work. You know, we try to be really supportive. You know, I think, like, again, the number one thing is, like, people just want to feel valued. People want to feel like they're making a difference. Right. And yeah. those are the most important thing, is like, give them the tools to empower them, to do a great job, empower them, give them an awesome work environment, provide them with everything that they need. And that's kind of the Snap culture in a nutshell, I would say.
Yeah. I kind of like how you flip the script though, where you weigh portfolio and their side projects and whatever they've done, whether it's even sample projects for you guys, more than the cover letter and the resume.
So when we're hiring people, there's a bit of trial and error, but over the years, but eventually we kind of zeroed in on what we think works pretty well. So first thing is just like, we'll just kind of review the applications. I really like reading through cover letters, because resumes, people can, you know, put whatever they want on there. And, you know, what we found was, like, you know, Nick, for example, our marketing manager, we hired him, like, you know, right out of school, didn't have he had some experience, but not like a ton of experience. But, you know, he's a really smart guy, and, you know, not all of that is going to show up on a resume. And a cover letter, I find you can really evaluate how people communicate, just a bit more about their character. So that helps us kind of just do that initial filtering who we want to kind of pass through the next round. Then we do an interview. Interview is very culture-based, right? Especially with a small team, like, we don't want to be hiring people that just, you know, aren't going to be able to work, you know, autonomously, and, you know, people who aren't self-starters and just don't have a great attitude on life. It's amazing how some people come into interviews with just, like, you can just feel the negative energy, and it's like, man, like, we don't want people with negative energy coming into the office. And then the third thing, like you alluded to, is a sample project, because it doesn't matter how great someone looks on paper, or, you know, they can say all the right things, but when you give them a sample project that is very, you know, similar to the work that they're going to be doing on the job, that's when you really, I find, get a good idea of, you know, how capable they are. And so what we started doing was, we actually do paid sample projects. And this way we can give them, like a full day or 2 days worth of work. And we pay them for that, so that even if they don't get the job, you know, at least, you know, they're getting compensated for it. And then that way it gives us much more assurance that, they will kind of be able to do the job well. If we do hire them.
I'm assuming, you know, your latest hire in May was probably the whole thing A to Z was fully remote. Cause you probably made the transition from local physical hires to remote work to, maybe finding someone with a broader geographic presence, but fully remote. So one of the things that I've found interesting, cause I'm a consultant and, you know, there's a big change going from being somewhere maybe over 3 years and then jumping into fully remote work. During COVID,
we've actually been remote since day one.
Okay, was the interview process fully remote then since day one, like over video conference and stuff?
Yeah. So our first two hires were actually in Ottawa, but I can't remember if we did the interviews on video conference or not, but the last two were definitely over video conference.
And what I'm wondering is, you know, what I see as a challenge is building social capital at work in a fully remote environment. Because when you have, maybe it just takes time, but you know, in a physical environment, you have a little bit more water cooler, spontaneous interaction. You hear a lot more about each other's lives. You have less, you have more on appointed time to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And in a fully remote, you know, world, you make appointments, you have meetings. I find it more difficult to build social capital in the sense of, even leniency around like, oh, my kid's running into the room. forgive this, you know, when I was transitioning with people I'd worked with for a long time into more remote, it was, all right, well, we've heard that we know who your daughter is. We've met her even maybe at the Halloween party, you know? So how do you find in the fully remote world, since the beginning even, how do you guys build that social capital within? Is it just through like deliverables being met? Do you guys have social engagements that are on Zoom or, you know, in the physical sense?
Yeah. So, it's an interesting thing with the remote. And that's actually one of the things that, you know, we kind of look for in the interview phase as part of, you know, is this person a good culture fit? Because there's some people that just, you know, just very social creatures and crave that like in-person interaction, maybe, you know, need to see people every day and aren't used to kind of, you know, working on their own. And so one of the things that we would always ask in the interview is like, have you ever worked remotely before? And this is obviously, you know, pre-COVID and stuff like that. And, you know, what's your home setup like? And just kind of, we try to ask questions to see whether or not this person is capable of working on their own, capable of taking, or essentially working on things without necessarily be told exactly what they need to work on, that kind of stuff. But to answer your question about the social capital, we primarily communicate through Slack. And so we try to, you know, for example, in the morning, you know, we'll always say like, you know, good morning, like, you know, and then, you know, maybe share an anecdote or whatever. On Mondays, you know, it's always like, you know, how was the weekend? You know, everyone kind of talks about what they did over the weekend and anything exciting, whatever. On Friday, we'll talk about plans for the weekend. If I watched like an awesome show on a Tuesday night, on Wednesday, I'll say, oh, I started the show. It's really awesome. And so kind of almost trying to like recreate that in-person environment where typically when people come into the office, the first half an hour is usually just getting the coffee and shooting the shit with the coworkers and, you know, and we almost try to recreate that to some extent in Slack so that, you know, we get to know people beyond just, you know, what they're doing at work. Pre-COVID, you know, we also used to do in-person meetups and stuff like that. And, you know, essentially like company retreats, if you will. And, you know, I found like that was really great to kind of, you know, get to know team members on a bit of a deeper level and build a bit more of that camaraderie. You know, we'll see when we'll be able to resume that. That's kind of been a bummer over the last year. But yeah, we definitely try to, you know, sprinkle in some of that in-person interaction when we can.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, talking about compounding, you included a great quote in your blog post, "It Pays to Play the Long Game." Compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. He who understands it earns it. He who doesn't pays it. Albert Einstein. You know, I don't think we need to get into the statistics of compounding, but you, again, you know, in this blog post, you bring it to more than just your bank account. I mean, at a high level at your bank account, you know, at 10% a year, you're going to double your money every 7.2 years. And that's something I heard when I was very young, and it was a very important notion to me. You know, we no longer, you know, you can't get 10% in a bank account anymore. Or anything like that, or, you know, anything sort of guaranteed in the fiat world of it. I don't think you can get 10% anywhere, especially if you factor in inflation. So, you know, but, it, you know, so even before, what's amazing to me, and specifically, you know, looking at where you've been, it's like that notion to me was awesome and powerful, but like I wasn't getting the 10% anywhere. You know, I was young. I was using my free money to live a high tide preference life and enjoy myself. I was, you know, saving for the future with my 401k, whatever, but like, and probably maxing it out and all that and trying to be as low tide preference as I can. But I was still having a good time, and I wasn't getting 10% anywhere. But it's amazing that with Bitcoin, like even that notion of 10%, I didn't go and tell my friends at every, you know, nightclub or, you know, bar I was at or where, or lounge or party, like yo I got this bank account with 10%, like just start putting in $100 a week and we're gonna double that shit in 7 years, you know, like, you know. But what I find interesting about this, you know, blog post is you bring all that back to more things than just your bank account. So you bring it back to, you know, the case for entrepreneurship, and I think you've kind of hammered that already. Another quote you put though that I think is really powerful: entrepreneurship is living a few years of your life like most people won't, so that you can spend the rest of your life like most people can't. Anonymous. I think that's really interesting. I think another thing is Dan Andrews predicted, and you note this, that it takes about 1,000 days to replace you, you know, or 3 years to replace your corporate salary. And again, that's just speaking to, you know, taking a longer view and trying to figure out what you want to do and how you can monetize it and make more for yourself after a period of time. Give something up now for later. And then to get to, you know, health and longevity. So we're going to touch on that in a minute. But right before that, you talk about the big picture and you kind of talk about just, you know, you cross-reference a few things here. So high time preference, low time preference. Spending money, high time. Saving money, low. Fast food, home-cooked meal. Scrolling Facebook, reading a book, watching TV, working out, consuming content, creating content, casual sex and marriage. That last one I think is really powerful. And I think we're kind of going through, I think, a lot of these changes now, or we're coming close to going through these changes. I mean, in a fiat world, is, you know, music is all about casual sex. You know, religion's disappearing, whatever your views on that are. But that, you know, I think that's very, you know, honest of you to share that. So, you know, now here we are. The business is doing great, or I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're thinking about the balance sheet. And, you know, it's 2020. And what I also find interesting is, you know, when you wrote about it was in August, but things happened before that. So, you know, and I'm assuming, you know, you have some time, you got control over your life a little bit or a lot. I mean, you're through what you've built, you're sovereign. I don't want to speak for you, but you're in a lot of ways, you got, you know, you own your own business. It's recurring nature. So what brings you to Bitcoin and why even speak publicly about it?
So I first heard about Bitcoin in 2017, but I just didn't pay enough attention to it at the time. So I bought a little bit, not a lot.
So you bought it. You heard about it and you bought it. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah.
Let's not discount that. I mean, that's ridiculous to discount that. I heard about it earlier than that. I didn't buy it. I didn't, you know, when I heard about it, I didn't understand. I was fascinated by it. I thought it was the coolest thing I ever heard of. Mm-hmm. But because it solved the problem for other people, I thought it was so cool. Like, you could do what you want with your money. And that's so freaking cool. But like, I was doing everything I wanted with my money anyway.
Yeah.
I never saw the store value part. And when I first came across it, I didn't have any money to store. So you bought it. I mean, that's a big deal. I mean, you heard about it and went and clicked some more buttons, put your driver's license in somewhere. So what even happens there? Like, why'd you buy it?
Yeah. I couldn't even tell you, to be honest. Like, it was like 2017 seems so long ago now, but you know, it was, I think I bought it because, like, you know, oh, programmable money, like, this sounds cool, like, this, you know, and it was more like the as a tech person, a software person, just the idea that, you know, you can, you know, hold this money and send it anywhere, and that the technology piece of it, right? And so I think I only bought like $500 or $1,000 worth, or something small like that.
Which is a lot of money. It's a lot of money to just throw at something that's cool.
Well, I mean, I thought it was going to go up, right? Like,
I get it. Yeah, I get it. I mean, but it's still like, you know, it's something. It's not to be discounted.
Yeah, and then, you know, the problem was, you know, then I started hearing about Ethereum. You know, it's going to be better than Bitcoin because it's got all these tech features. And then so I bought a bit of Ethereum, and again, like, at the time I didn't really understand why Bitcoin was valuable, and why, well, my opinion is that Ethereum is probably not going to be valuable, but anyways, and also at 2017, like, this is when the business was, like, you know, really starting to fire here. And so, you know, that's really where a lot of my attention was, and the macro environment was completely different as well, right? So I was still in this fiat mindset of, like, I need to increase my fiat balance sheet, and I need to grow more dollars.
If you put $1,000 in Bitcoin and it goes up 5x, which is astronomical to someone who doesn't know what it is or hasn't studied it, I think that's a great return. That's not a lot of money to someone who's building a business. And so I still think it's fascinating, you know, you went and bought some. I bought some in 2017 as well, a little bit later, probably in the year than you did. So there's, you know, a lot more number go up just being in my face, but I didn't mean to interrupt. But
So that was kind of the thing, right? And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. But again, like, I'm kind of spending more time on the business. I didn't go down the rabbit hole at that point. And then so the, you know, the parabola comes, and then the huge crash. And then I was just like, oh, okay, maybe this was just like a flash in the pan, and maybe it was a fad, you know? And then I really kind of didn't really spend too much time on it. So fast forward to 2019, and business is going really well now. And you know, I've been getting into, I always was into, like, index, like, low cost index funds since an early age kind of thing. But around 2017, 2018, I started getting more into, like, individual stocks because, you know, through my work, I'm getting exposed to all of these companies like Shopify and DocuSign and Square. And so I started investing in some of these companies, and, you know, those are, you know, doing really well now, which has been fortunate. And so I'm listening to the Investors Podcast with Preston Pysh, and this is like 2019, and he's talking about Bitcoin. I was like, oh, this is interesting. Like, Preston's a value investor, and he's talking about Bitcoin, which to me didn't seem to fit with, you know, the Warren Buffett value type investor. And so I'm listening to these episodes. I was like, oh, okay, this is really interesting. Like, you know, clearly there's something I'm missing here with Bitcoin. And then I started, I read the bullish case for Bitcoin. I read the Bitcoin Standard, you know, start reading some of Plan B stuff. And then all this stuff starts to click, right? And I was like, oh, okay, that's why Bitcoin's valuable. This is why everything else is a shit coin. This is why, you know, the Bitcoin, quote unquote, being slow is actually a good thing. And then all this stuff starts to click. And so at that point, I take a bigger position on the personal side. I start buying more personally. But even at that time, I'm like, okay, this is like a speculation thing. You know, I'm going to put like whatever, 2 to 5% type of thing. And I think on the personal side, I got to about 10% of my portfolio.
Which is a lot.
Fast forward. Sorry?
That's a lot. I mean, yeah. I don't think it's a lot now. I'm all for 100%. But I mean, you know, it's not something, looking back on it, I think that's, you know, in 2017, 2018, 2019, I'm thinking 1%, 2%, 3%, 5%, 10%. And then it wasn't until a certain point where I'm hitting 50%, whatever. But, you know, it's not something to discount again, you know.
Yeah. And this is kind of gradual. I'm kind of making it seem like, you know, this is over periods of like months and maybe like half a year where I'm going from 1 to 10%, let's call it, right? Every book I read, every podcast, I'm like, oh shit, like you learn something new and you know, one of my favorite graphs about Bitcoin is like on the x-axis, it's like your knowledge of Bitcoin. And then the vertical axis is like your percentage allocated to Bitcoin. And it's like a 45 degree. That is exactly what my experience has been. Like just the more I learn about it and the more inevitable it seems, the more I've kind of increased my net worth in it. Right. But anyway, so now fast forward to 2020. And COVID hits and no one knows what the fuck's going on. Our bank account or the interest rate on our bank account gets slashed to 0.45%. So we're basically making fuck all. And, you know, essentially we're like the money's on our balance sheet is, you know, decreasing in terms of purchasing power. And as a business owner, it's like, you know, we've worked our ass off over several years and, you know, like it's, we want to make sure that like we maintain the purchasing power and all that work that we've created and protect that value. And then, you know, you start seeing like these central banks just going crazy and unchecked. And then it became this thing where I was like, you know, like I think we need to buy Bitcoin under the company balance sheet. And then, so similar to the personal thing, it was like, let's just start with, you know, 5 to 10% kind of thing. And then next thing you know, there's just more printing happen. You're seeing this kind of like K-shaped recovery. And then, you know, March happens and there's that huge, you know, liquidation or whatever. And then we're like, okay, I think we need more than 10% here. Like at this point, we're legitimately worried about the state of fiat currency. And so at this point is where everything really flipped, where it wasn't Bitcoin is this, you know, hedge, if you will. Now I'm thinking like, we need more than a hedge. Like Bitcoin's going to be the new system. This is what is going to, at a bare minimum, maintain our purchasing power. And obviously we thought that there's a lot of upside embedded in it as well. And so, you know, essentially over the course of the next few months, starting from, you know, February, March timeframe, you know, we start kind of daily, weekly buying into this thing. And then eventually we get it up to over, you know, 50% of the balance sheet. And then I ended up writing the post in August about, you know, why we did that and kind of the thought process, because, you know, like a lot of people in our space, you know, they're not thinking about this stuff. Like, you know, a lot of, you know, friends and kind of, you know, other founders that I know, like they're software people, they're marketing people, they're tech people, like they're not macro people. Right. And so that was kind of my way to say, hey, you know, you all might want to take a look at this, you know, to protect some of this cash on your balance sheet. And that was, and another thing was, I knew that, you know, my friends and family, I wanted them to have some as well. And so I tried to also write the post in a way that isn't just applicable to like business owners who are, you know, stack it on their balance sheet, but write something that I could send my friends and family saying, FYI, I think you guys might want to take a look at this. Here's kind of my thought process and reasoning. And then if they have questions, you know, I'm happy to help, but you know, then it's kind of up to them whether or not they want to take further action.
Yeah. I mean, I think the post is quality content. I recommend everyone go check it out and read it. I'm kind of curious how long you were podding, like listening to podcasts before 2019. Like, were you a big podcaster? Was it a lot of economics? How often were you podcasting, you know, listening? And then I'm assuming, I don't know, did it change after you got into Bitcoin? Like, you know what
so
I mean?
I used to listen to, well, I still do, but primarily I listen to a ton of like business and entrepreneurship podcasts because, again, like 24.
So more on like the business and marketing, not so much on the macro investing.
Yeah.
Like so, I find like, you know, when you macro invest, like you do like a macro investing pod before Bitcoin, I'd be like, oh yeah, again, like if I could get 10% here, that'd be great. I don't know where I'm going to find that. I would listen to one podcast, be blown away. But with like you were saying with Bitcoin, I want a podcast all day. I never wanted to like do macro and I love macroeconomics, mm-hmm. but like the content didn't fire me up before Bitcoin. I didn't have an opportunity to seize a piece of a network in a fair manner or something scarce before Bitcoin or something that wasn't manipulated. I mean, you would think about guaranteed, but things are only guaranteed to the extent that someone provides the guarantee. So I was kind of curious about that. And then, you know, but then also it's like one thing I really want, you're a CEO and co-founder and it seems like, you know, every CEO is on Twitter now. And it seems like the younger ones are much more honest, interactive and transparent, sharing, whatever you want to call it. Do you think that's part of the job now? Do you think there's risk to that? Like, you know what I mean? Like to share so much. And I guess maybe the risk, I don't know. I don't, you know, but is, you know, it's like the more vulnerable and truthful you are, the more it's going to resonate. But then, you know, you're sharing more and you might not resonate with everybody. I don't know. Like, how do you feel about sharing as a sharing as a CEO?
Yeah. So just to touch on the first part about the podcasting. So, you know, like 2014, 2018, like I don't have that much money in the bank, right? So let's say I've got, you know, like if you're a young person and you've got $1,000, right? Even if you put the $1,000 in Bitcoin and it 10x's, you've got $10,000. Like it's probably not going to change your life.
I agree.
If you start a business that is now kicking off $10,000 per month, that's freaking life changing, right? Mm, and then if you start putting half of that into Bitcoin every month, that's really life changing. So my mindset in 2014 wasn't how do I grow the wealth that I've already created? It was like, I need to create wealth, right? And like I said before, half of it was the wealth and half of it was the lifestyle. Like I was just as attracted. I was more attracted to the lifestyle than the wealth component, to be honest. I think they kind of go hand in hand. And that's why, like, you know, when it comes to podcasting, I was listening a lot more to about business podcasts. Like, how do I grow this thing? You know, how do I get, you know, how do I, you know, learn this marketing stuff? And then in 2018, 2019, that's when I started listening to a lot more investing stuff because I kind of found with the business podcast, I was getting almost like diminishing returns where there's only so many new marketing techniques. There's only so many, you know, people you can listen to about how they grew their business before it kind of all starts sounding the same. And then the other thing that you realize is that every business is different. There's no manual, you know, there's not a single person that is going to give you, you know, the blueprint to how to create a successful business. A lot of it is trial and error. There's a lot of luck involved. And that's, you know, a big part of that is going to have to be your personal journey. And so like 2019, you know, that's when I really started to like, okay, you know, got some cash flow here. I got more money in my bank account. Like how, you know, now I'm thinking like, how do I make this work? How do I really compound this and grow this even faster? And that's when I really started to listen to a lot more of the investing and the macro and the business podcast. to go back to, you know, your last question about sharing and whatnot, there's a lot of, at least what I've experienced is there's a lot of like serendipity when it comes to, you know, sharing things on Twitter or writing articles about it. You know, I've met so many like awesome people, even just, you know, putting out that article and tweeting about it. Like I was listening to, you know, Tales from the Crypt for like the last year or two. And then just because I wrote that article, I ended up, you know, recording with Marty, and like, that was fucking awesome. And the thing is like, if I wasn't on Twitter and if I hadn't wrote that article, I would have never been on Tales from the Crypt.
Right.
So my thought process is like, I try to produce as much as I consume, and that has typically worked out for me. And I think like, you know, even like these macro people now, they're all on Twitter, right?
Right.
Because, you know, that like people want to see the human behind, you know, the business, or they want to see like, hear that person thinking in real time and what their thought process is. So, I mean, I definitely think that in 2020, there are definitely, you know, there's some drawbacks, of course. But I think there's more benefits to being online and sharing your thoughts than there are drawbacks. That's kind of the way I think about it.
Yeah. So as a you know, I'd say a successful and budding entrepreneur, you know, you have the stair-step approach, and it seems like you're approaching the final step. So before we get into the final step, which is Bitbo, and talk a bit about that, like how'd you get to the final step? What are the steps, you know, that an entrepreneur goes through?
Yeah. So one of the guys I really, really admire and look up to, in especially in this like soft bootstrapping software community, is Rob Walling. He's just put out so much great content over the years. He has a podcast called Startups for the Rest of Us. It's one of those podcasts where, you know, I pretty much listen every week. Mm. And he outlined this framework called the stair step approach. So when it comes to startups, and especially in the tech industry, you know, a lot of people have been conditioned to follow this path of, you know, you need to swing for the fences, you need to raise a bunch of money, and you have to be a unicorn, you got to be growing at 30%, like all this kind of stuff. And it sounds super sexy, and you know, you watch The Social Network and you read TechCrunch and you hear about all these billionaires and super successful people. Mm. But what you kind of realize is like, there's so few people that actually make it, and like 99% spend 2-3 years working their ass off and grinding it out and essentially come out of it with nothing and then have to go back and get a job. And so Rob's kind of framework of stair-stepping is to start really small and kind of work your way up from there and stair-step, if you will. So step one is basically launch a single one-time sale product with a single acquisition source. So this would be something like a WordPress plugin, or it could be an ebook. So like, let's say you're, you know your way around the gym, you're super shredded. You can, you know, put together a quick little ebook of how to get shredded, sell it for 20, 30 bucks. You know, that's a perfect step one business. It's not going to, you know, make you rich, but it kind of gets you comfortable with like how to do marketing, how to, you know, put up a landing page, how to, you know, how to do all that kind of stuff. Step two is essentially to like double down and repeat that step. Maybe you launch another ebook, or you know, you add some like, you know, coaching services on top of whatever, and until you own your own time, right? Mm. And that's the key, is so you can quit your job, you can do this full time. And then step three is the recurring revenue, right? And so that's basically, you know, typically a SaaS business, could be like a some sort of, you know, paid community and whatnot. And once you've got that recurring community, you know, that's when the game changes, right? Because you can start really thinking long term. It's much easier to scale. We talked about all the benefits of the SaaS business model ahead of time, and that was step three. And that was kind of what Rob laid out as the stair stepping approach. Rather than starting out at step three, and rather than, you know, swinging for the fences on day one,
right,
you kind of work your way up. You kind of develop that tool belt, and that will make it easier to get to that step three. It sounds counterintuitive to, you know, why don't I just go to step three? Well, you know, why do I have to do step one and two? But the thing is, if you don't learn the skills on step one and two, it's going to be much harder to. Yeah, exactly. So that was kind of the stair step. So, you know, we've gotten to the point in our life where, like, I'm not like loaded by any means, but, you know, at this point I'm, you know, we're financially stable. And I kind of realized, like, okay, so, you know, I can keep growing this business. I can keep making more money, but, like, you know, what's next? And kind of come to the realization that, like, you know, ultimately I want to get to the point where, you know, I'm working on something that I'm more, you know, deeply passionate about on a personal level. Because Snap is a fantastic business, but it's not like I have, you know, some burning desire to, you know, create graphic design software, right? Like, we just saw a really good opportunity and a gap in the marketplace, which is why we launched the business. And so, you know, we've obviously gotten really big into Bitcoin over the past year. I'm a huge believer in all of the, you know, possibilities that it can afford and, you know, all that kind of good stuff. And so, you know, that's essentially what led us to create Bitbo. And we hope that we can keep, you know, growing on that. And, you know, again, like, the ultimate goal for me is to work on something where, even if I didn't have to work on it, or if I was, you know, retired, that I just want to do it anyways.
Yeah. I mean, I like it a lot. I'm on it right now. I'm looking. It's very clean. You know, I love Bitcoin dashboards and, you know, there aren't very many. What is the goal for Bitbo? You know, where are we going with it? Before we jump into some of the things that are on it, what I do like, actually, you know, I will mention, is, like, you have some really great stats right away. I mean, you got the chart for the day, you got the 24-hour range. What I really love, US dollar per Satoshi, and Satoshis per US dollar. I think we just got to start talking about Satoshis way more. you know, I talk to people, and, you know, I mentioned, you know, you don't have to buy a whole Bitcoin. It's divisible by 100 million Satoshis, and they get very flustered and perplexed. And then you try to explain that, well, there's a dollar, there's quarters, dimes, and nickels, and pennies, and they take that as back in the hand. So I think the more we say Satoshi, sats, bits, whatever we're going to go with, and even both, because people can handle more than one term with quarters, nickels, dimes, pennies, I think the better off we'll all be, and the people will see it as more easily to convert their savings into this thing. Mm-hmm. I like that, you know, you kind of have the blockchain stats, you know, block height. I love seeing that. Difficulty stats, times between blocks, mining stats. So where are we going with this? What are you guys' goals?
Yeah. So, you know, the reason we built it was, again, kind of scratching our own itch. You know, what we found was, you know, a lot of the kind of, so again, like, our belief is that this is kind of a winner, either a winner takes all or a winner takes most. And there's, like, I don't know, 6,000 cryptocurrencies, like 99% of those are going garbage. To zero. Garbage, right?
Well, they're all garbage, yeah. But yeah, I'm sorry. Exactly. Yeah, but I mean, yeah.
Well, that's my opinion, but, you know,
my opinion too. I didn't want to go too hard, is what I'm saying. I think it's all garbage.
Yeah. And so when you go to these, like, you know, freaking, you know, Coin Market Cap or some of these other sites, you're just, like, inundated with the shit coins, right? And one thing that we were, you know, there's another dashboard created by Clark Moody, which, you know, we were kind of inspired by. But Clark's thing was, he wants just that snapshot in time. You know, there's no charts on there or anything like that. Mm. So what we realized was, like, we couldn't find anything that was, like, Bitcoin only, where everything was all in one place. And that's essentially what we're trying to create. So right now it's a one page dashboard with the chart, whatever. And so where we're going with this is, you know, you're going to be able to click on, you know, hash rate or difficulty, and we're going to show you that historical chart of the difficulty and the hash rate. A lot of people are really interested in, like, you know, the exchange. So, like, GBTC, for example, you know, right now we've got the premium. A lot of people are like, you know, the premium is 24% right now. Is that high? Is that low? Right. A lot of people are into tracking that. So essentially, the kind of near-term goal is to take this dashboard and, you know, for almost every stat, create its own page with that specific, you know, all the historical and the charting as well, so that you don't have to go to like 3 to 4 different sites to see, okay, what's the price, you know, where's the hash rate at, what's the QBTC premium, and just keep it focused on Bitcoin, super clean UX, and just like, I keep this open all day. Like I can't stop looking at it. Right.
I'm looking at it right now. I really like it. I'm thinking a lot about what you just said, and I'm enjoying that. I like this idea of building everything. Everything can be kind of shown in a chart at some point.
Yeah.
Especially those other factors that you were speaking of, like hash rate and difficulty adjustments.
I was just going to say, like, I mean, there's just Bitcoin. I mean, you've obviously been down the rabbit hole. It's just, there's so much stuff. It's so fascinating. And you know, when you, again, like when you go to these other sites, like CoinMarketCap, like you're not getting any of this stuff. Right.
Well, I mean, I'll just say, not only not getting it, but like, I went through the evolution that you speak of. You know, I bought Coinbase, I bought Bitcoin, and I bought it on Coinbase actually, and then I would go to Coinbase to check the price. And I didn't even like going to a proprietary site that was commercialized. I wanted to find something that was more, neutral. So then I'm at CoinMarketCap, and I got the same problem though, as I'm seeing all these shit coins, and I don't even care that other people see them. I don't want to see them. I don't want my brain to see them in the same place. I'm very convicted. I don't care about them, whether, you know, in the sense of if they bring technology that's going to be horizontally transferred into Bitcoin, great. If not, I'm not worried about it. I think it's a little bit more of a distraction than, I don't think it's a total negative, because these people are closer than no coiners and pre-coiners to Bitcoin, and most shitcoiners have Bitcoin. And so I don't want to be completely negative, but I just can't. And so I didn't want to be on coinmarketcap.com anymore. So I love that this is just all Bitcoin. And then this is more, what's great is more than just price. I love that you got the mayor multiple up here. I wish Trace would come back. I love that one of your favorite metrics is the 200-day moving average. What I'm curious about is, aside from maybe gold prices or GBTC prices, is all this, where is this data coming from? Is it coming from the Bitcoin time chain? Is it coming from Lightning? How do you calculate and aggregate this data? Like around price even?
Yeah, so most of it is like all the blockchain stats. Like we're running our own nodes, and we're pulling all this info directly from our own nodes. Again, like it's something that's so fascinating a bit about Bitcoin is like you can verify all of this stuff on your own, right? We're just providing it in like a very, you know, nicely packaged, easy to consume way. And then with the price, we're just using. I think it's a crypto compare API. So some of the stuff, some of the like the non-blockchain stats, we're using like APIs, but anything that's native to the Bitcoin blockchain, we're pulling that, all of that stuff with our own nodes.
Got it. What is your perspective on this project in terms of and where you are in your life now with like kind of not having gold in handcuffs? You know, being able to kind of focus on, you know, your passion project and monetize it, you know, down the road. What kind of perspective has that given you? I don't think a lot of people, achieve that at any point in their life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's what's great, because if we were starting from scratch, we wouldn't be able to launch Bitbo because it makes no money right now. It costs us money to host all this data and to provide the data. But we're able to do that because we have a profitable business. And so, you know, we're happy to kind of fund this project for the next, for the foreseeable future. And again, you know, going back to this whole, compounding and long-term thinking kind of thing is, we're happy to take that long term approach. We're not sure if this is going to be the site that can generate, enough traffic to, you know, monetize purely just off like sponsorships or whatnot. We might just keep this as a almost like a lead generation site. Maybe we launch a completely different product, and because, you know, we have so many eyeballs on this site, maybe we use that to kind of, you know, promote the next project or whatever. We don't know fundamentally where it's going. What we do know is that since we've launched it, a lot of people are loving this dashboard. You know, again, we want to promote and stay true to the Bitcoin only ethos. We want to keep, you know, working on this and developing this. And you know, we're happy to take that long view. So even if this, you know, doesn't make us money, even in the next 6 to 12 months, we're okay with that, because, you know, as long as our other business is chugging along. And now that we're on a Bitcoin standard, if Bitcoin keeps mooning, then, you know, another reason that we can just keep doing this for free, you know, somewhat indefinitely. So again, that's kind of, you know, what, to me, what step four is all about is like, you know, we don't have to do this, but we want to, just because, you know, we want this product to exist. We like looking at it ourselves. Fortunately, a lot of other people seem to like it and are getting value from it. You know, we just want to put cool stuff out there and hope that other people like it.
Yeah, man, I think the site's dope. I'm looking at it right now, and I think I'm going to be staring at it all day, every day, as I usually do Bitcoin. I'm looking at the site right now. We broke 22,000. I didn't even know until we I did. Looked at holy your site. Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Holy fucking shit. So, you know, I mean, it's been a wild year. You said it before that 2017 feels ages ago. I think that Bitcoin is kind of like dog years. You know, every month is like 7 months. Every year is like 7 years. Mm. Where do you think we're going next year with Bitcoin? But I want to say more like 10 years. I want to stretch things out. You know, like what is your take on, I'll call it hyper Bitcoinization. I think it's inevitable. I don't want to lead you, but you know, where do you think this is going to take us?
Yeah, I mean, like the monetary system already seemed like it was, like there were definitely some cracks, right? And you know, ever since 2008, 2009, it was clear there was cracks. You know, 2018, we saw some weird stuff going on with the Fed, but you know, it seemed like they were able to, you know, add enough liquidity and kind of, you know, somewhat keep it afloat. The debts were really high, but you know, the government's kind of somewhat promise to, you know, wind down the balance sheets and pay the debt back, kind of stuff. In 2020, it's absolutely clear that they're never going to be able to pay the debt back. And the only way to get out of this situation is through printing their way out. So with that, I just don't understand how, when people see Bitcoin going to 100K and then 200K and then 500K. Like how do people still not jump ship, right? Like Bitcoin is going to be the life raft to this transition. So I'm definitely of the opinion that because of the incentive structure built into Bitcoin, the game theory behind it is just absolutely fascinating. You know, as soon as the billionaires are on board and you get a couple sovereigns on board here and there, the cat's out of the bag at this point, right? So I feel that we're heading to hyper Bitcoinization. I have no freaking clue how long it's going to take. You know, some people talk about maybe this is the last cycle. If I had to bet, I would say that this is likely to happen probably in the next cycle, if we're talking about like pure Bitcoinization, where the world is moving to a Bitcoin standard. I think we're still a bit too early. But at the same time, I'm not selling any of my Bitcoin in the cycle, right? Because it could go all the way. So I'm not, even though like, I think the odds are, we're still 4 or 5 years away from it, I'm not taking any chances because we could theoretically go all the way. And so I think that is essentially going to be the transition where you're going to have central banks continuing to print to essentially keep this existing system afloat, because they can't stop printing at this point. Otherwise, the thing would literally just like freaking collapse. So I think what's going to happen is you're going to see more printing. You're going to see MMT, UBI, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, the smart people are going to realize like they need to take that fiat, put it into Bitcoin. The people that have these like 30-year mortgages, the people that are taking the debt, like they're solid because the housing prices are going to go up or whatnot. But the lenders, I think they're going to get freaking wrecked because, and I don't know really know what they're going to do, because the purchasing power of those dollars is going to be worth so much less down the road. So that's kind of like my overall thoughts is I'm just continuing to stack Bitcoin. I'm not going to sell any of it. If we get this some kind of crazy run up to like $1 million this year per coin, maybe I shave a bit off the top and put that into like equities or real estate, some other, you know, kind of asset. Because at that point, like Bitcoin would be like 99% of my net worth. So it's just kind of prudent. But you know, I plan to keep the majority of my net worth in Bitcoin because, like you said, I think it's inevitable at this point.
Yeah. I'm bullish on Bitcoin price. I'm also, I might be bullish on denial. And I don't know if the mainstream is going to come around to Bitcoin regardless of price. You know, Michael Saylor's laid down the gauntlet. He's incredibly smart. The smart people know he's in. Anyone who's paying attention is buying. I don't know if we're going to break through, especially now that we've broken 20, 21, 22,000. I don't know when people are going to tune in. Maybe at 100K, maybe at 500K. And you know, I'm not sure. But I agree with everything you said. I don't know if people are going to come around. And I'd rather see, that's why I want to talk about Satoshis all the time, is because I'd rather see people who, you know, are saving and trying to protect their wealth over time and don't have the access to stocks, bonds. And I'm not even sure when I recalibrate back in terms of out of Bitcoin. I own some stocks through various instruments or even just cash. I used to buy some stocks now and then. But I'm not excited about stocks, and I don't see myself being excited about stocks inevitably. I don't know.
I was just gonna say. So a couple thoughts. Where are you based out of, actually?
I'm out of Chicago. Well, okay, nice. Chicago, yeah.
So I live in Canada, and something I like that kind of scares me is like I just the stuff that I hear out of like the prime minister and the finance minister, like it gets kind of scary when they start talking about like preloaded stimulus and asking for ideas about how to get money into the economy. And this is something that like 2-3 years ago, the whole censorship resistance thing and being able to like take your wealth across the border, I would have never really cared that much about that. Like that's kind of like the doom and gloom kind of.
That's actually why I got into Bitcoin. Like,
yeah,
in some regard, number go up. But like, I was like, if I ever need to move money, like the worst case scenario, I thought I'm going to establish a position in this very movable money.
Yeah.
Because, but it wasn't my use case, but it was like my almost back of mind favorite thing.
Yeah. And I think most people that live in like, you know, are fortunate to live in, you know, United States or Canada or these developing countries, like no one's thinking about like, I need money so that I can, you know, peace out from here if things get rough. Like it's just,
I never thought we
never thought you need it, but let me tell you,
but now
again, I hope it doesn't get to that. And I don't think we will, but, you know, we've seen some crazy shit this year. I'm hearing some things that kind of scare me a little bit. And so as someone who runs an internet business that I could work from anywhere, I have an EU passport because I'm half Italian.
Flag theory.
Yeah, exactly. So I've got an EU passport. So if, you know, the government comes out one day and says, listen, you know, we need, you know, we took on too much debt. We're jacking up the tax rates to 90%. Like, you know, I love my family and friends and it, you know, I don't necessarily want to move, but like, I'm out of here. Right. And so that's another reason why, like, increasingly I'm like, I want most of my wealth in Bitcoin because I'm getting, again, like I would have never thought these things 2-3 years ago. But you can never be too prepared. And it honestly scares me to have too much of my net worth in the legacy financial system in case, you know, they start implementing some of these crazy capital controls or insane or untenable tax rates or anything like that. So yeah, that's something that I'm thinking about.
Yeah. I mean, my fiat at this point, I'm with you 100%. My fiat's only for spending and consumption optionality. Everything else is in Bitcoin. And I slowly move existing assets into Bitcoin. I still think that we're in a bubble. I don't think that this is getting to everybody.
We are in a bubble. Like it's, I mean, that the real estate is just going through the roof. Like how can you have record unemployment and like
all time
just insane real estate? It doesn't like it just, and I don't understand how, you know, Jerome Powell and the central bankers can say with a straight face that pegging interest rates at 0% isn't driving wealth inequality and asset price inflation. Like it's just mind-boggling to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think they know. I think they're just lying. I think they're incentivized to speak that version of their perspective.
Yeah. And I think part of it is probably just they have no choice, right? So like if they don't, then the shit really, really
have no choice, and they're benefiting in the short term, which has been a really long time. I don't know when things change. You know,
this is what I love about Bitcoin because there's a, I can't remember if this was the prime minister or the, I think it was Trudeau who said this. He said, now is not the time for austerity. Well, we supposedly have been in a bull market for the last 10 years.
And there's a lot of austerity.
And we freaking ran up deficits, right? Right. Well, and now we're in a pandemic, right? And we're going to have even more deficits. So when is the time for austerity? Well, we know the answer. There's never a time for austerity.
Right.
So with Bitcoin, you can't print more Bitcoins, right? So you have to face the music. Like you can't kick the can down the road. You can't delay the inevitable. You can't screw up the pricing.
It's not in their interest to print an incredible amount of money to then accumulate that money into Bitcoin, regardless of how society integrates into Bitcoin. You know, there's no end to how much they can print and how much they can use that to buy hard assets like Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So I don't see them stopping. I don't see them recognizing the issues we're discussing because they have no need to. You know, they benefit from not.
Yeah. Well, they're past the point of no return, right?
Right. So I agree.
And that's the thing. It's like, so at this point, we know what the game is, right? You know, they tried to, you know, maybe you believe them a couple of years ago that like, yeah, they're gonna pay down, you know, they're gonna balance the budget and they're gonna wind down the central bank balance sheets. But at this point, like it's literally impossible, right? Mm. So there's only one way out. And the people that are paying attention are buying Bitcoin, and those that aren't are going to get wrecked. And you know, I'm trying to make sure that, you know, my family has some Bitcoin, and the people that I'm close with, and you know, we have it on the balance sheet because I don't want to take the fall for you know, a failing monetary system.
What do you want to be working on in 20 years? Or not working on?
I mean, for the next little while, I want to be in the Bitcoin space. Like it's just, as a finance guy, and a, you know, a tech guy, it really does tick all the boxes. I think even for the humanitarian reasons. Like, I agree. We need to get rid of these overpaid bureaucrats that are like, the incentive structure is not there, right? The incentives are all misaligned. And let's face it, Bitcoin is more fair and equitable than what currently exists. And that's kind of, I think a better future. So, it's something I want to be a part of.
That's awesome. I want to tell everyone Bitbo is a real-time Bitcoin dashboard that allows anyone to monitor on-chain data, view live price action, and track key economic indicators all for free. It's really dope. I particularly like the color scheme with the orange lettering. I'm just staring at this thing and recognizing a lot of little almost Easter eggs. This has been so dope. Do you have any parting words? And definitely let everyone know where they can find you. But, you know, and I do want to say, you know, that if you guys have any questions, comments, or feedback regarding Bitbo, reach out to, you know, the realist Mark or C Gimmer on Twitter. But, you know, definitely let everyone know everywhere else they can find you. And if you have any parting words, you know, the floor is yours.
Yeah. If people want to interact or whatever, you can follow me on Twitter. Handle is @C Gimmer. If you want to check out some of those articles that we discussed, you can head to chrisgimmer.com. All my writings on there. And check out bitbo.io for check out all the on-chain metrics and the price action. And, you know, hopefully we go from 22K to 100K over the next year and beyond. And looking forward to 2021.
Yeah, man, this has been so dope. We're going to have to catch up soon, especially as this site grows. We'll definitely have more to talk about.
Thank you so much, it was a fun conversation and enjoyed being on here.
Thanks, man. Peace.
Christopher Gimmer on turning your entire life into a giant flywheel by playing the long game, combining your business with your personal passion right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dig the chats, please subscribe and give a 5-star review wherever you dome your pods. Those reviews are the best way to get the word out so I can keep grinding out thought-provoking conversations on Bitcoin. If you're interested in sponsoring the show or just want to shoot the shit, hit me up. My DMs are always open. This is Cedric. Peace.